Hello and welcome to the Female Athlete Podcast for women who want to learn more about their bodies. With me, Lucy Lomax.
Me, Georgie Brimbals.
And me, Jess Piasecki.
For today's episode, we'll be focusing on menstrual disorders. This includes conditions such as ovarian cysts, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, PMDD, fibroids, polycystic ovary syndrome, and endometriosis, plus many more which we will be touching on. There are a variety of different dysfunctions out there, and like we did with contraception, we're splitting this big topic into two different episodes so that we can do it justice, and it will also enable us to speak to different females about their experiences. In this episode, part one, we speak to two women who have suffered from endometriosis while competing at the highest level, Olympic champion cyclist Eleanor Barker and 1500 meter runner Sarah McDonald, who both give very honest accounts of their experiences.
First, they just thought it was period pain, but I was in agony, like terrible pain. And they put me on the pill, tried to put me on the pill back to back, tried different pills. At the first year of uni, I still couldn't cope. And I remember being at home that summer, and my parents would alternate between who slept on the floor next to me, because at night it was probably the worst. And there was times when they'd take me to A&E, they would give me morphine, and they would let me go because there wasn't much they could do. And I was just waiting at that point for an operation to see a specialist, and it wasn't till I had the surgery in the summer of 2012 that it really got diagnosed.
I just think awareness is really, really important, because if I'd have even heard of endometriosis before I was diagnosed with it, if I'd seen that list of symptoms, I could have just walked straight in and said, I think I have this, I want to have surgery to find out if I do or not, and I could have done that straight away, and I probably would have done, but because I didn't know, I didn't have that power.
But first, before we dive straight in, our talking points or highlights of the week are slightly different this week as we acknowledge the events that have been going on around the globe in support of the Black Lives Matter movement. As you'll likely know, the death of George Floyd, the subsequent protests around the globe, and the support for the Black Lives Matter movement has generated conversations and significant debate about racial injustice and police brutality in recent weeks. What I want to say is, and I'm sure Georgie and Jess, you have plenty to say on this as well, but how great it's been to see the sportswomen who have really been kind of leading the way and addressing racism worldwide, from Coco Gauff speaking so eloquently about race at a protest to, I think it's Darcy Bourne, an England under 21 hockey player. She's spoken out and attended protests. England netballers, I think it's Ebony Osorio-Brown, Layla Guscoth, and even England footballer Nikita Parrish, she's come out and written an open letter of apology, apologising to former teammate Eni Aluko about how she's acted in the past. I think she writes about how she made Eni feel isolated and separated after allegations were made about the racism that she experienced under the then head coach Mark Sampson. So I think everyone's kind of waking up and just having a think about how their actions have consequences. And what I would also just say is that it's been slightly alarming to read about how there's just such an absence of Black representation or BAME representation in many female team sports. I think I was reading hockey, England hockey can name just four BAME female athletes to have represented Great Britain at senior level, which is ridiculous. And rugby, I read an article recently with Maggie Alfonsi, who's a former player. She's talking about her experience of spending the majority of her England career as the only Black player in the team and how worried she was about standing out. I'll include a bunch of links in the footnotes of this episode to read, as obviously I think educating ourselves around this issue and putting ourselves in a position to really push for change is what we should aim to do. So that's what I've got to say on the topic.
Yeah, I think that's well said, Lucy, and entirely agree with everything that you've just said. It's a really, really sad event that's happened, and it's really sad to see that something like this has had to happen to make a change. And I think, you know, reading all the news articles and things, it says we were doing the same thing 100 or so years ago, and, you know, it's still happening now, and it is very, very shocking. And it's nothing that, you know, myself, I can't even imagine, because I am white, so it's nothing you can't put yourself in their shoes even. So I think it's really important that we do educate ourselves on this. But as you say, it's nice to sort of see the sports right across all platforms come together. And in particular, I think, you know, I follow athletics very closely. So there's past athletes like Alicia Montana, who's in the US. She's always very, very well spoken about this. And Marilyn Okoro, I think she said something. Dina Asher-Smith. So particularly for sports women, you know, as a female athlete podcast, it's really good for those people to sort of share their experiences and help educate, similarly to we are doing with different topics on this podcast. But I really do hope people can make a change and just begin to realize sort of the effects that this does have.
Yeah, I mean, exactly what both of you said. You know, I just can't believe someone like Coco Gauff at age 16 is like standing up there and really helping to get that awareness going. And I think people like that are going to be game changers. And I really hope that the next generation of athletes and the general population have a much more fair and inclusive approach. It's really, really sad. It's like taking this severe event for this to like really highlight the need for change. But hopefully off the back of this, we can like positively influence things.
Now today, we're going to talk about menstrual dysfunction. Now, if you don't suffer from a disorder or dysfunction, it can be very easy to bypass these issues. I certainly know that I've done that. I've learned a lot about the different types of menstrual dysfunction just from planning these episodes with you, Georgie and Jess, and speaking to the guests who've kindly kind of given their time to talk on the podcast about their personal struggles and experiences. It's been very eye-opening for me, and we hope that it's eye-opening for you, our listeners, as well. So I'll hand it over to you guys to get the ball rolling.
So thanks, Lucy. As you alluded to, we are going to talk about menstrual dysfunction. So there are a variety of dysfunctions, but today's episode we're going to focus on three particularly. That is endometriosis, ovarian cysts, and your endometrial polyps or fibroids. So we're going to take this episode to work through these three in particular. We'll talk about what each one of them is, how common it is, and primary symptoms and things. So we'll start off with ovarian cysts. Now, ovarian cysts are very, very common, actually. And they normally are either functional, which is where the cyst might arise as part of the menstrual cycle and disappear, or it might just be there and it doesn't really cause you any harm, any symptoms or anything like that. You can have pathological cysts, which could then develop to become something more erroneous or a little bit serious, but this is again very, very rare and is normally only an issue after you've gone through menopause. So the majority of women do actually have cysts without knowing. In a severe case, the cyst can rupture and you'll get an onset of like quite very sharp pelvic pain. And obviously if that does happen, then ring your 999. But normally after, even if it does rupture, then it's quite simple to deal with and you will be fine. So please don't worry about anything like that. Some symptoms may present themselves if you do have a cyst. So this could be some type of pelvic pain. So it might be quite dull or heavy sensation or some sharp pain. But this might come and go as well with the menstrual cycle at different times of the month. You might have an increased frequency to urinate. Your periods may be either heavy or irregular. And again, this may fluctuate month to month, perhaps, depending on if the cyst like grows within your menstrual cycle. You could have a bit prone to a bit more bloating or swollen tummy. But in most cases, like we said, a lot of people have a cyst and they're not very aware of it. So if you were concerned that you did have one, it's quite easy to identify a cyst in that you can speak to your GP, your medical practitioner, and they would often refer you to an ultrasound scan. And that will identify like where the cysts are, if they're on both ovaries or just one, if you have a few or just one, what size they are and so on. And if you don't really have any symptoms, that'll probably be it for you. But sometimes a GP, depending on like medical history, family history, they might want to monitor it every 6 months, 12 months and so on. Or if you are sort of peri, postmenopausal, then you are more likely to be closely monitored with the cysts. It's really, really common, and it's not necessarily something to be worried about. But what I did find interesting was when I was looking through the research and the literature that there wasn't much out there in terms of any associations with exercise or sort of how you can prevent any cysts or what are the sort of common features or genetic characteristics, for example, with ovarian cysts. So, Georgie, did you have anything to add on ovarian cysts in terms of your experiences with dealing with athletes?
Yeah, I think my only thing really to say is that like I have worked with athletes who've had ovarian cysts in the past or who have had them like recently when I've been working with them, and they seem to be very insidious. So they just happen and you don't necessarily know or have any warning signs. Like as Jess said, often people have them and don't know. Often they burst and that's when you actually find out that you've had one or there's a lot of pain. But it seems to be that if you have one, you might be more likely to then have another one that might burst. But even then, I just don't think research is there yet to really understand that. I think the key thing is like if you've got one or if you know if you've had a cyst that has burst, like don't overly worry about it. Like obviously it's very important to seek medical input then, but getting over it, recovering from it is like a very quick process for the majority. So it's all about just being proactive. If you think you might have that, something like that, if you have pain in that area, then definitely seeking medical guidance would be the way forward, but also not overstressing.
Okay, so the next sort of dysfunction we'll touch upon is endometrial polyps and fibroids. So we sort of grouped these together, but I will deal with them individually, I suppose. But the differences here is that a fibroid develops within the musculature of your uterus, so sort of within the muscle lining, whereas the polyps are within the cavity. And polyps can come sort of either on their own or there might be a few of them. And polyps are often associated with abnormal bleeding. So you might have some bleeding in between periods. They might cause irregular periods in general, or they might cause some bleeding, you know, after you've had menopause, been through the menopause, you might have a little bit of sort of spotting or random bleeding, which could be a sign that you have a polyp. But again, most women don't have polyps. So 39% of women premenopausal have sort of abnormal bleeding with these polyps, but then nothing else. And 28% in postmenopausal females have some onset of random bleeding as well. Again, it's not that much of a concern. You can have the polyps removed. And if you do find you have one, more likely when you're younger, you're more likely to have it removed just to make sure it doesn't grow or cause any other problems with anything else. And if it does cause sort of irregular bleeding or even heavy menstrual bleeding, then people can have them removed, but also they could take a form of oral contraceptive sometimes. I've spoken with some people that that's the case, but it's not necessarily a cure. I think it's very much a try it and see kind of situation with each individual, and that will obviously be guided by your medical practitioner as well. With a fibroid, again, this is very, very common, and a study I found in the US, 25% of all women in the US have fibroids, and they can vary in size, so some might be the size of a pea, some might be the size of a watermelon I came across. So that's quite a big one. So again, this might cause some pain, but most of the time it's relatively unknown that you don't have one, or that you do have one, sorry. But when you might come across it is what, if you were to get pregnant, fibroids are often sensitive to estrogen. So they have an increased growth rate during this time. And that's where you can sometimes feel like little lumps in the lower abdomen in someone who's pregnant. That's obviously not the fetus, but that might be a fibroid that's popping up. And often with fibroids in pregnancy, the doctors would keep an eye on them, make sure they're not sort of in the way of anything in terms of the growth of the baby. And later on, it might be removed or it might just shrink as you give birth and so on. Some fibroids may cause like heavy menstrual bleeding, increased urine frequency, fullness of the lower abdomen, but relatively few issues with sort of fertility of things like that. I think a lot of females do worry about that when they have these kind of diagnoses. But there's very little information out there as to, you know, this polyp does definitely cause infertility or fibroid. That's not the case at all. It's relatively unknown. And again, when the literature, there was no sort of associations with exercise frequency or anything like that. So it would be sort of interesting to sort of develop into this later on. And yeah, I think that's sort of mainly all there is to say about these fibroids and polyps. Georgie, do you have anything to add in terms of your experiences with these?
I think one thing that I would say is like a tangible thing to do if you think you might have one of these, or if you do have these, like, be really mindful about using hormonal contraception. We know that polyps, for example, are estrogen sensitive, so having a high estrogen content form of hormonal contraception could actually exacerbate the problem. And with fibroids, you might actually want to look at using a non-hormonal form of hormonal contraception, depending on the severity of the fibroid. Again, I have worked with athletes with both of these, and I guess I've done a lot of work around trying to understand whether there's any dietary risk factors. And there is some research to suggest that not having enough vitamin D, consuming a lot of red meat and not eating enough fruit and veg, alongside having excessive amounts of alcohol, may well be risk factors. Also, I think stress is something which we always need to have in the back of our heads as well, just because of the way the stress hormones can interact with the like whole menstrual cycle regulatory process. So they would just be my thoughts. But again, the athletes that I've worked with who've had these have been fine, and it doesn't seem to really have affected performance, providing they're managed well.
Yeah, I think that's the key thing with these two in particular anyway, in that I don't think, obviously it's good to know and identify the problem with your medical practitioner, but I don't think there needs to be an excessive amount of worry, but just be mindful and aware that you have it. So that's why I think getting these diagnoses sooner rather than later is better, just so you become aware and then can make future plans and things like that accordingly.
Yeah, definitely. And in terms of polyps and fibroids, I'd say then putting in the preventative measures around like just avoiding risk factors where possible. And
exactly,
being mindful that if you've had them once, then you know what, obviously at the time it's horrendously painful, but if, for example, if a cyst ruptures, or with fibroids, I know there's a huge amount of pain, but yeah, just be mindful of that.
So the last sort of menstrual dysfunction type, which I think there's a lot more evidence and research around this problem, is endometriosis. So Georgie, what would you have to say about endometriosis?
Okay, so yeah, there is increasing amounts of discussion, exposure, highlighting around endometriosis. I think there's loads of complexities of this condition, which I'll go into in more detail in a minute. But essentially, if we step back and think about what endometriosis is, okay, so this is a condition where the lining of the uterus, so the endometrial lining, actually effectively travels to other parts of the body and sticks to them, and then grows and kind of lives there. Primarily, this occurs around other kind of lower abdominal or in lower abdominal areas. However, there is that, well, for a relatively large number of people, this tissue can also spread throughout other parts of the body, for example, to the diaphragm, to the liver. There have even been reports of people having endometrial tissue in the nose, which is absolutely horrendous for them. And so now, I guess, again, stepping back and looking at this, endometriosis is a chronic condition, so it's a long-term condition. It's not like a cyst where there's a cyst, it can rupture, goes away, potentially comes back but might not. Endometriosis is a long-term condition, and it's a pro-inflammatory condition. So we know that people with endometriosis have higher levels of like baseline inflammation in their body, so their body is just like more sensitive to inflammation and has a greater amount of inflammatory markers in their body. We also know that it's, as a condition, it's very sensitive to estrogen. So when estrogen levels change throughout the menstrual cycle, then like it would affect your uterus and your endometrial lining, so the lining of your uterus, where estrogen levels change, they also affect any part of your body that has this endometrial tissue growing. So for example, when you have a period and you lose blood in your like endometrium, there's also like almost mini periods going on in different places where there is this endometrial tissue. And we know that having like a menstrual blood loss, like for that process to occur, there's like this inflammatory response. So we know that there's little inflammatory responses going on in different tissues wherever this tissue is sitting. And that can cause an enormous amount of pain. And so if we again look at the symptoms associated with it, pain is like a primary symptom, but we also know that there's a whole range of other things that can occur. We know that heavy bleeding can be a symptom of endometriosis. We also know that symptoms can be very similar to irritable bowel syndrome. So people often describe this like long-term pelvic pain. So it's not just located to the ovaries or located to the uterus area. It's actually like across the whole pelvis. And that's likely because the endometrial lining is actually sticking or adhering to different tissues around that area. We also know that there can be pain with bowel movements and pain with urination as well. People often experience increased fatigue, delayed recovery, diarrhea, fertility problems. But it's really important to realize that this can vary a huge amount. So some people have no symptoms at all, whereas some people can have really, really extreme symptoms. So there's a whole range of like levels of severity, and that's likely driven by the amount that the endometrial lining has actually spread or the distance it has spread. So as a condition, it is actually surprisingly common. So we estimate that around 10% of all women have endometriosis. But also it's very much an underdiagnosed condition. So typically it takes 7.5 years for diagnosis. Research says anywhere between 4 and 10 years for diagnosis, but actually the kind of overall estimation is around 7.5 years. And we know that based on that, or you can imagine that based on that, there's a whole load of people out there suffering in silence who don't actually realize that they've got the condition. Now, and we're going to hear later from our a couple of athletes who actually have endometriosis, and they explain their story for how they got diagnosed. But I think the key point is that diagnosis of endometriosis is actually really, really challenging. Historically, the primary way for diagnosis was through this thing called a laparoscopy, which is where effectively a camera is inserted into the area around your belly button to then have a look and try and find this endometrial tissue or where the endometrial tissue is growing, and then effectively that tissue can be removed. However, once you've got endometriosis, as I said, it's a chronic condition, so it's likely to come back. So that's not, I mean, that is a primary treatment option and an effective option, but there's also a case of being very mindful to look at other risk factors, other modifications that can be made to reduce the likelihood of that tissue like continually regrowing. Again, just going back to this diagnosis point, there's, I guess this is a hot topic because it, clearly you don't want to have like an invasive procedure if you don't need to. And also because it really is hard to diagnose, it's hard to know when, like, what is that point at which you should suddenly start discussing the possibility of having a laparoscopy. So more recently, there seems to be a push towards using other means for diagnosis. So there's a few like symptoms which I just highlighted, which you can run through as a doctor. You would run through them, and as a patient, you should be looking at them and wondering if you've got any of them. But also alongside that, like, there is more research suggesting that through clinical examination and through medical imaging, there might be an increased ability to actually identify who might have endometriosis, and then like that removes the need to have the laparoscopy until a bit further down the line when you might be more certain in terms of whether endometriosis is actually there. In terms of treatment options, so obviously I mentioned the laparoscopy, that could involve a full like removal of that endometrial tissue. It also may involve just a biopsy, so removal of a certain amount of tissue to then go and test it to see more and try and understand more about that. Hormonal treatment is often common. However, considering this is an estrogen dependent condition, you would want to go down a progestogen only form of hormonal contraception. There is also some emerging research around the potential for diet and exercise to really help manage endometriosis. Again, stepping back, it's an inflammatory condition. So following every anti-inflammatory form of diet possible would be definitely advisable. So for example, looking at omega-3 intake, fruit and vegetable intake, also looking at vitamins, vitamin B, vitamin C, vitamin D, vitamin E, looking at intake of them. And also looking at fiber intake generally, I think that's really, really important for gut health, also to help the liver with the metabolizing metabolic processes around metabolizing estrogen, for example, particularly because of the sensitivity of this condition to estrogen. And also, I would say just be mindful around caffeine intake, saturated fat intake, alcohol intake, etc. There's also some evidence around gluten intake and potentially reducing gluten intake to help with the management of symptoms. Again, it's like it is very likely to be individual. So tracking cycles, tracking symptoms, trying to understand what works for you and what works for your specific symptoms would be super, super important. Jess, Lucy, do you have any questions or thoughts?
I have one question, which some of the listeners might say, is that obviously if you don't know you've got endometriosis, for example, you've got no symptoms, is this going to cause you a problem later, like if you decided to have children? And is that like the only time that you would find out?
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, it could be, for sure. Like it can affect fertility, but saying that, like, it's, you know, many people get pregnant and don't have a problem if they've got endometriosis, but that could be a time where you do find out. But I still think, like, without doing a screen of every single woman out there, we won't fully understand the prevalence and implications of this. I also think that it's really important. I feel like I've gone through all of these like crazy facts and bits of information about it, but as we're going to hear in a minute, like, it is perfectly easy. It's not easy, but it is a condition which can be managed. And I think, again, it's all about looking at like a lifelong management plan, or through your fertile years management plan, and working out again what your body's sensitive to, what your body what you can do to help your body. And I think that's what I would just really suggest anyone with endometriosis to do, to like step back and work out what works for them. Because like with premenstrual syndrome and menstrual symptoms, full stop. Everyone's situation presents a little bit differently. But again, always have in mind that endometriosis is an inflammatory condition. So like going above and beyond to manage that is super, super important.
If anyone has any questions about any of the topics we've discussed today, then please send them over to us and we will discuss them on our next episode. Well, today we are really excited to have Eleanor Barker joining us to share a bit more about her specific menstrual cycle experiences. For those of you who don't know Eleanor, she is a track cyclist. And she is a multiple Olympic and world gold medalist. So thank you so much for joining us today, Eleanor. As you may have gathered, a big like focus for this podcast for us is to talk all things menstrual cycle and talk about different aspects of female physiology. Going back to like when you were going through puberty and going back to your younger self, like, was this area ever discussed with you? Like, did you ever have any education around it? And what were your kind of general menstrual cycle experiences?
No, to be honest, didn't really. I mean, certainly within sport, no education as to how it might affect performance or or anything about that whatsoever. And I think there's quite a lot of kind of taboos maybe in cycling when you're a bit younger that kind of make that figuring out process a little bit harder. So things like you're not supposed to wear underwear underneath your cycling shorts, but if you're just starting to get your period and you're not really sure how everything works, that's quite a lot to get your head around when there's kind of the cycling set of rules and then the your time of your month set of rules that don't really work together. I think there are quite a lot of things that you just have to kind of work out on your own and work out what works for you really.
Wow, I definitely didn't realize that. That's crazy. And obviously you've spoken about having endometriosis. When you were growing up, like, did you realize that your menstrual cycle was maybe a little bit abnormal? And like, how did that, I guess, like affect you generally in training, racing, etc.?
I actually ended up using hormonal contraception from quite a young age because of the pain that I was getting, during and around my period, but it wasn't really ever very specific. And I've kind of found that with the symptoms that I've had of endometriosis, where I hear a lot of other women's accounts of it, is that it's very painful periods at a certain time of the month and then the pain goes away. Whereas mine just doesn't seem to be in any way related to a cycle whatsoever. It's quite random. Sometimes it lasts for a few days, sometimes it lasts for 2 months at a time before it goes away. Well, this was pre having surgery anyway.
Yeah, and I think actually that's a common like misperception around endometriosis as well. Like often you just think, oh well, I would just experience pain like pre and during, but actually for endometriosis sufferers, they can experience pain like continually, which is just horrendous.
And we're obviously with the podcast, we're kind of hoping to break down a few taboos and open up the conversation a bit more. But obviously, I think it was last year when after you had your surgery, you came out and you spoke about it very openly, because I think it's 1 in 10 women suffer from it. So it's actually quite common. So can you just give us a bit of a brief outline of maybe, what it was like pre-surgery, how you, because I read an article about you going to the doctors and saying like, this isn't normal. This has to be something else other than just my period.
Yeah, so I think the first time I went to the doctor to say, I feel like I'm getting more pain than my friends more often and not triggered by anything, was I think 2014 maybe, towards the end of it. And then I finally got surgery in 2018. So yeah, it was about 4 or 5 years of going to lots and lots and lots of different male doctors, who most of them said, this is just normal, like you just need to put up with the pain, this is just your life now. And there's a lot of times that I was like, I don't know, I don't think I'm going to accept that. And then finally, I got referred to a female doctor who's a specialist in that area, who I don't know why I wasn't referred to on day one, it could have saved me a lot of time, within a couple of 10-minute appointments, realized what the issue was, got booked in for surgery, and it was fairly straightforward from that point onwards.
And how has the surgery kind of transformed your life, if you like? How has it made your made everything better?
Just a lot less pain, really, is the main factor. And I think I was getting quite a lot of fatigue, because being in pain for long periods of time is just really, really exhausting, particularly if it's on top of the the pain that you've got from training or from injuries or anything like that. And it can affect your sleep, it can affect your eating. So all those things on top of one another were really affecting how I felt my training was going. I've just felt really, really tired all of the time. So I think it's kind of given me a bit more energy, if anything. I mean, yeah, the pain is a big issue, but the fatigue was what really, really was affecting my performance.
Yeah. How did you manage it when you were, because you said you had this pain for almost 4 years before you had the surgery, and you obviously had the Rio Olympics in between that, and I know the European Championships as well. Just, did you have any strategies that you went to, or did you just use painkillers?
Just painkillers, to be honest. I'd say I had a fair few strategies that didn't really work that well. I think I've kind of found that trying to be a little bit preventative is probably the best thing that I can do. So if I wake up feeling in a tiny little bit of pain, I'll just take some paracetamol, because I don't want to wait for it to develop to something worse. Also, there's a few kind of odd tricks that I found can help a little bit. So if I'm feeling like I've got a little bit of pain or anything like that, I find what can really, really push it over the edge and make it worse is if I feel bloated or really full, or my bladder's full or anything like that. So if I'm in a block of time where I'm getting more pain than usual and I'm having bad symptoms, I'll basically just try to go to the toilet as often as I can, make sure I'm not getting bloated and having any carbonated drinks or anything like that, and also not allow myself to get too full, because I've just found it really pushes the amount of pain that I can tolerate over the edge.
God.
Obviously, you mentioned that being diagnosed took a long time and you saw many, many doctors. Like, through your experience, like having now gone through that and sort of on the other side, like, what do you think needs to change in that sort of process from your own experiences? Or what would you like, to happen?
I think having people be listened to immediately. And I suppose... I almost felt like I was going out of my mind a little bit, because I felt the pain was very real. And then I'd speak to somebody else about it and they'd say, oh, it's all in your head, or it's really normal to have that amount of pain or something like that. And I just really didn't think it was. But I think my advice, I just think awareness is really, really important, because if I'd have even heard of endometriosis before I was diagnosed with it, if I'd seen that list of symptoms, I could have just walked straight in and said, I think I have this, I want to have surgery to find out if I do or not. And I could have done that straight away, and I probably would have done. But because I didn't know, I didn't have that power. I also think what I wish I'd done myself going back is that I wish I'd had a really, really detailed account of every single doctor's appointment that I'd had. Because you do end up going around in circles and you end up having to have the same tests again, and it puts the same delays on it again and again. Whereas if I had in front of me notes that said, on this day I did this test which came back as this result, and on this day I took this course of antibiotics and it had no effect or whatever, then that's something physical that I can show a doctor to say, look, I'm on top of it, I know what's going on. These things didn't work, let's try the next thing before we try these again. I think it was very frustrating trying to find something that was wrong and constantly being told that there wasn't anything wrong. And then once I saw the doctor that did the surgery and who gave me the diagnosis, things did feel a lot better, because I was like, phew, it's probably this. I think one of the big issues at the moment with endometriosis is that the only test is that you have to have surgery. And that's how you are properly diagnosed. So there was always kind of the fear that I'd have this surgery, I'd end up, I think I had to miss 2 races to have the surgery because it's in the middle of the season. And then I wasn't really back to full gym training for about 2 months, I think. And there was always the kind of the risk that I would take myself away from training from that amount of time and not actually gain anything from it. So that was quite scary, I think. It was a big relief when I woke up from the surgery and realized that, yeah, that was exactly the problem, and should be easier from there on out.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, when you're going back to like your diagnosis, when you're coming to a clinic or whatever saying I'm in pain, being a cyclist and a highly competitive sports athlete, you think they think, oh, maybe she is, you know, in pain. Your pain gauge is probably quite real. So throughout all this time, were you able to talk to your fellow like coaches or support team or fellow cyclist team? I don't know how in the ins and outs of that, were they like quite supportive about that? You just mentioned you missed some training, but were they quite, you know, supportive? And did you have those open conversations about everything or?
I think a little bit of both, actually. So at some points, I think it kind of depended on me and how I felt it at any given time. I think at some points I was just so exasperated that I just had to say exactly how it was. And my coaches took that on board. And then at some points I felt a little bit like, I don't want to be that the weird girl on the team that's always complaining about her ovaries. So I should probably just stay a bit quiet for a little bit. And I think, yeah, quite often still will say, oh, when I had that stomach problem, rather than actually explaining what it was, because I think it, yeah, there still is some kind of stigma, even though I'm aware of that and I don't want to buy into that, I'll still quite often skim over it. Even if I'm talking to my coaches and my teammates who have been really supportive. And actually it was my coach who pushed me to have the surgery when I did, and to miss the races that I did, when actually I was really nervous about it and kind of scared to make that decision myself. He just said, look, we'll get it done as soon as you possibly can so that you can get back on track as soon as you can. And then, yeah, look forward to training pain-free as soon as possible.
Generally for like young female athletes out there, not necessarily those with endo, like what advice would you give them around general like discussion around the menstrual cycle and how they should approach it generally?
I'd say to educate yourself as much as possible and try and keep some kind of diary. I mean, there's loads of tracking apps out there you can use to try and find your own pattern and your own cycle and that sort of thing, but I would definitely say educating yourself. And I mean, I feel a little bit hypocritical for saying that, because I've literally just in the last 2 months properly learned about menstrual cycles and about the different phases, because I always kind of saw it as you're either on your period or you're not on your period, and that's the two states that you're in, rather as like a constantly changing hormonal balance that actually every single day almost is a completely different day. And I think being able to actually harness it and use it and maybe work your training around it if that's possible, to some extent.
Last question for me, Elena, is just obviously coming from the journalism side, which I'm coming from, you talked about your endometriosis and your experiences with that over when you were ready to, and obviously Heather Watson came out and mentioned her when she couldn't be even like competitive in a tennis game because of her menstrual cycle, and the world sort of gasps when she mentioned it in an interview afterwards. But do you think that's kind of the key to getting kind of women's issues, I hate that phrase, but like getting it covered by the mainstream media a bit more often? Do you think it's a good thing for female athletes like yourselves to speak out, basically?
Yeah, I really do. I think it's the kind of thing that can help the general public, sports people who are up and coming, or even, so for example, in between being diagnosed potentially diagnosed with endometriosis and having surgery, I went to the Commonwealth Games in Australia, and bearing in mind that a month or so before, I'd just been told that I've probably got this thing that I've never even heard of. I was really nervous about how it's going to impact my career. And we're at the Commonwealth Games, and I was sat with all my teammates, and we were watching the swimming. And the girl that was winning the swimming during the commentary, they talked about how she'd had this surgery the year before.
Emily Siebel.
Like, yes. Yeah. Exactly. And I was like, oh my God, that's great. I can literally see this person on my screen succeeding in a relatively short amount of time. After having the same thing that I'm so incredibly worried about, I'm going to be fine. It's going to be completely fine. And I think it kind of takes that fear away because I didn't know anybody that had had that surgery before. All of the staff around me and men, nobody could really tell me how it was going to affect my return to training or how soon I'd be able to race again or anything like that. No one really had any knowledge about it. Whereas now I had a name that I could go in and Google and I could see a timeline between everything that happened to her and kind of fit that into my life to try and make some kind of prediction as to when I'd be able to return to things as well.
Thank you so much for coming on, Eleanor. Like, we appreciate it so much. And like, for anyone out there who has endometriosis, like, I think you're just such an inspiring person to follow and just to demonstrate that you can perform and it doesn't affect you. And you can, if you have the surgery, then you're all the better for it as well. And yeah, we really, really appreciate it. So thank you. And good luck for the next year, 14 months until the Olympics next year. All very exciting.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Good luck.
Yeah, thank you for having me as well.
Okay, so today on the podcast, we've also got with us Sarah McDonald, who is a World Championship semi-finalist in the 1500 metres and is also a European medalist. And she's going to talk to us about her own experiences with menstrual dysfunction. So thank you for joining us, Sarah. It's a real pleasure to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So how did you get diagnosed? Like, how did you realise that you had endometriosis? Because you must have been pretty young then.
Yeah, so I actually started having problems probably when I was in sixth form. I remember having like terrible period pains, like horrific. My mum taking me to doctors and trying a few different things then, because at first I just thought it was period pain, but I was in agony, like terrible pain. And they put me on the pill, tried to put me on the pill back to back, tried different pills. And at the first year of uni, I still couldn't cope. And it, every time I took a break off the pill, it would just be unbearable. And the summer of 2012, which was the end of my first year, it was to the point that the pill wouldn't even stop that pain. And I remember being at home that summer, and my parents would alternate between who slept on the floor next to me, because at night it would probably be the worst. And there was times when they'd take me to A&E, they would give me morphine and they would let me go because there wasn't much they could do. And I was just waiting at that point for an operation and to see a specialist. I'd had various ultrasound scans, but they don't really show endometriosis. So it's like everything they were testing was coming back clear. And it wasn't till I had the surgery in the summer of 2012 that it really got diagnosed.
Yeah.
And that was probably like 3 years lead up to that point. But I saw a really good doctor, a GP that had worked with the Royal Ballet, and he kind of had a suspicion of that. And he sent me to the hospital and said, like, look, I've seen this before in girls and I think this is what the problem is. Yeah. So I think without him, I'd still be in limbo.
Wow, that's amazing. You poor thing. And was the pain like day in, day out? Because some people experience just regular pain or others just have it around like their premenstrual window and when they're actually menstruating.
So at first I found it was just around like the period time and like if you were actually actively bleeding and just a bit before that. But then I think because I'd held off on actually trying, taking the pill back to back and stuff, that it just started coming all the time, and it was always in the evening or at night, and it was just unbearable. And it was like getting me down so much because I wouldn't be able to sleep at night. And I think it was putting a lot of strain on my mum and dad because they were so worried about it too. Yeah. But it almost felt like it's like just a really extreme period pain, like a stabbing pain. And it would like, the only way of really relieving it would be to put heat on your back and then it would take it away completely. But we tried everything, like sticky heat patches, the whole shebang.
And now are you like completely pain-free from it? Like, do you ever get recurrence?
Yes, so I had a laparoscopy, and also the doctor at the time suggested that I underwent some medical therapy for it as well. So ever since then, I've had what they call Prozac injections. And that induces a menopause. So you don't have a monthly cycle so that the endometriosis doesn't grow back as much. Mm-hmm. But that treatment in itself has come with so many side effects and problems, like an increased risk in stress fractures. It's like you get hot flushes, night sweats, everything that you would expect of menopause. I also experienced, and that I found it hard to come to terms with. I felt like my body was going through a different time to my head, yeah. almost, and I found that mentally very difficult, and it was hard for a while. Like, I almost felt depressed because of it. And there are still times now where if I do get stressed about something external, then I do start to feel the symptoms come back again or exacerbated, yeah. but not. I've never had it since that it's been that bad. I was quite apprehensive before the surgery because I was worried about having a big scar on my tummy, like having all that. And actually, you can't see it at all. It's simply like the tiniest, tiniest cut through the belly button and like a line just where your bikini line is. So it goes, so you wouldn't even be able to see it. So no one ever notices that I've even had the operation, and it's so like discreet that no yeah. one would be able to tell.
Because it's keyhole surgery, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, they just, to do it, they kind of inflate you a bit. So afterwards, it's just a bit uncomfortable. And you feel like you need to be winded.
Yeah.
I don't obviously advertise that I've suffered from it, but people who have heard from other people that I have it always like reach out and speak to me and like want to hear like what I've done, how I've managed it and stuff. And I think it would be better if there was more information around it and people were more aware of it, because I think a lot of people are probably suffering in silence, thinking it's just horrendous period pain when actually they can have treatment or they can manage it better, but they just don't know how to.
Yeah. So what was the process for you when finally you had that one doctor that kind of thought it might be endometriosis? What was then the process to you until you had the surgery?
So my doctor referred me onto a gynecologist in outpatients at the Women's Hospital here, and he referred me on a quick referral because obviously it was a hard time, like having to cope with that, and obviously my parents were at home and it was really difficult. And they then referred me on to just get an ultrasound to make sure it wasn't like a polycystic ovary situation or anything like that. I had some blood tests ran, and then I think they were very much, I think we need to do a laparoscopy and have a look now. And that would have also ruled out any other potential things.
You know, there's so many different endometrial dysfunctions out there, or menstrual dysfunctions, that people just don't talk about. And I think, like, you know, 1 in 10 people have endo. It's not like you're a rare breed, but then there also needs to be more kind of, I don't know, yeah, like discussion and support around it.
Yeah, it's definitely something that needs to be, the awareness needs to be increased. And I don't ever want people to feel like I felt at the start, like not knowing what was going on, feeling like you were completely alone. So I hope that now people realise that it's a bigger thing, and 10% of women do have it. It's a lot.
Mm-hmm. And when women make up 50% of the world's population, like, it is a huge amount, really, isn't it? And it definitely needs to be made more aware of. And like you say, you went through that whole diagnosis process, and it is a lengthy process. If people just knew more about it, then it might not take as long. And for people, you know, going through things like yourself, especially when trying to manage not only sporting careers, but, you know, any kind of career, people might be trying to manage a family at the same time. It's all relative, and everybody's got their own sort of difficulties with it. So hopefully we can help a little bit with this podcast.
There's a publication that's recently come out about dealing with COVID for endometriosis sufferers. I'll send it on to you, Sarah, actually, because I think it's really interesting, just highlighting that actually, obviously, at the moment, treatment is likely to be limited, and the impact of stress and changing routines, and that's something we've spoken about quite a lot on our podcast, but even dietary elements and how they can all interplay to affect people, particularly with endo at the moment. So I think it's so important to like just continually raise awareness around that and look at how people can be proactive and even just like help identify whether you think you might have it.
So, you know, when you sort of share your story, you said you don't really speak about it that often, but I think you have made it known that you've suffered from this endometriosis to a few people. Do you like receive feedback from other perhaps female athletes or just females in general when you do sort of speak about it openly? And is that quite positive?
Yeah, definitely. It always surprises me, actually. And I never really expect to have such good feedback about it. But I think it helps when other people know that they're not alone too, and other people go through it, and other people have managed it, and also other people have struggled through it. It's not easy. It's just a situation that you don't want to feel alone through. And it's hard to almost bring it up to people. And I think it's a lot easier to bring periods and stuff up now than it was before.
We'd like to say thank you to Eleanor and Sarah for giving us their time so generously to talk about the struggles that they've had with endometriosis and opening up the conversation to help other women understand more about the condition and what they can do to get help. It is also worth mentioning that we did have to cut the interviews with both Eleanor and Sarah quite significantly due to time restrictions. So if you would like to listen to the full interview with Eleanor and Sarah, please head to the Female Athlete Podcast YouTube page, where we've put up both those interviews in full for you to listen to. Okay, so for question time this week, we've had a question in from Sophie. And she says, I'm an ultra runner and generally compete in races that last from 10 to 30 hours. Last year, I started my period on race day about 4 or 5 times. Being at the competitive end of the field, my race phase takes over and I wouldn't realise I needed to change my tampon until I was out of an aid station and back on the mountain. This would result in me pushing it back up and just hoping for the best, not the most hygienic or, I imagine, healthy situation. What would you recommend as a good way of dealing with this? I don't wear underwear when I race as it chafes me, so pads, etc. are out. Obviously, leaving a tampon in for that sort of time makes me worry about toxic shock. Would a moon cup work better? Which is a great question, because I personally thought to myself that what's a more environmental good for the environment, because I know that pads and tampons sometimes get a bit of a bad rep in terms of their disposability. So yeah, what would you guys say to that one?
Firstly, I think that is a brilliant question, and I think we can probably all resonate with the whole game face approach. So I would say that actually some kind of menstrual cup would be my go-to suggestion in this scenario. Typically, a menstrual cup would hold for either twice as much as a tampon to 3 times as much as a tampon. So, and that's a super plus tampon. So I think that would be a good option. Obviously, the way the menstrual cup works, you could hypothetically remove that, empty it, put it back in again. Obviously, there's massive hygiene issues there. So being super, super mindful of that would be a massive go-to from my perspective. But I think, yeah, I would advise going down the menstrual cup situation if possible in this scenario.
Thank you for choosing to listen to us. That wraps up another episode of the Female Athlete Podcast for women who want to learn more about their bodies. And as we mentioned before, if you'd like to access the full interviews with Eleanor and Sarah, please do head to the Female Athlete Podcast YouTube page. The interview includes a bit more about the background of each athlete, how they're coping with lockdown, and of course, more detailed discussions about endometriosis. I'll include the link to our YouTube page in the footnotes. Thanks for listening.